So a quick note before we dive into today's episode. If you're trying to grow your business and you're wondering where the real gaps are, we built a free diagnostic tool that we're calling Q20. Give us 10 minutes and you'll get a custom analysis back. No pitch, no call required. ScalingCoach.com/Q20. Go there now. ScalingCoach.com/Q20. Growing your business can feel a lot like start and stop. Like, oh, are we getting this right? You got to recheck. That's what we're talking about today. How do you get your business right and ready to sell? Get things dialed in, get systems working so that you know and you can count on it. And that ultimately makes it more valuable. That's our conversation today. We're talking with a guy who helped grow and sell a company and is now working with others with one of the pieces that makes a company valuable over time. Hey, everybody, Bill Gallagher, scaling coach and host of the Scaling Up Business Podcast. Come to you every week with a show about growing your business and all the things that go into that, the people, the strategy, execution, cash, surviving the journey, maybe even enjoying it. That's our show. Find all those and more wherever you're getting this right now, or go to scalingcoach.com, and that's our own website where we have our own things, our coaching programs, that kind of thing. Check it out there, scalingcoach.com. All right, everybody. I want to welcome to the show Phil Risher. Phil is the founder of Flash Consulting. That's with a PH, all 90s style, Flash Consulting. And he's got a story about helping a company grow and sell. Not huge, though. Very relatable, right? Some of you, look, we can learn from companies of any size. We can learn from Southwest's rise and fall. We can learn from the growth of Costco. We can learn from how Disney's run. We can learn from companies of any size. But sometimes the most fascinating stories come actually from fairly small companies. And so Phil's got this company, Flash Consulting, that does marketing consultancy for service-based businesses. And he helped grow a company and then sell for, you know, a nice amount of money, a few million dollars. That helped. And I think the stories and the ideas here are really solid, no matter what size of business that you're running. So Phil, welcome to the show.
Yeah, Bill, thanks for having me. Something I'm very passionate about is growing businesses, and specifically in the home service space, there's a lot of opportunity for businesses to grow.
Yeah. So home service, one of the things that's great about it, whatever kind of is, it's recurring, right? Like having a thing back. It's funny, today and last week, we've had some contractors here, HVAC, plumbing, pest. We had a whole thing. First, I noticed my air wasn't working, the heating wasn't working in the house. That found some other problems. Then we brought some other things. There's been a steady stream of people by the house today fixing things that, you know, had gone unnoticed over my house about 160 years old. So it's got issues on the regular. But you you started with a company that just did air duct cleaning, and you helped grow that company and then sell inside of 2 years. And so I'd love to start at the back, at the end of it, kind of what made private equity come and look at a $5 million company? This is not a massive company. And I know a lot of our listeners don't think even at five that they can attract a buyer. Talk to us about that. Tell us that story.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think the bigger thing is the EBITDA number that they really attracted them. You know, it's $5 million to 30%. So it's like, you know, decent wheelhouse, like solid proven system, 25 years in business. This was a specific search fund that had a guy, you know, Columbia grad, was coming in looking for businesses, and he came across our business, and we were dominating the market in our area. We went, the search fund guy, the owner, and me went to lunch for the first introduction. Went to a place called Lazy Dog in Northern Virginia. We sit down and he asked me three questions. The owner at this point, I came into this business and he didn't know, like, he was stuck at 2.7 million, kind of like the hustler, you know, kind of thing. When I came in, I brought in numbers, strategy, all the data, and that's how we grew so quickly. So when we sit down, the owner's like, okay, Phil, talk to this guy and answer whatever questions he has about our marketing and sales process. And he asked me three straight questions. And this doesn't matter what size that you are. And they're going to ask the same question. How do you get customers coming in the door? So that way, when you move the owner, what's the process? How do you convert the leads into sales? And then how do you retarget your past prospects and customers? And I've gone on three of these sales calls now in the first introduction. They all ask me the same thing because they want to make sure when they remove the guy or they remove the person that it doesn't fall apart. And there's a couple of things they love to hear, which is we don't retarget our past prospects and customers because they're going to come in and do that. But that's basically what it was. That's how the sale process started. But that was really what attracted them to us was solid EBITDA numbers, which take the conversation from lunch to like, let's get into it, you know, get the LOI and all the stuff. That was kind of the starting point.
You know, a couple things I hear in that are worth like in broadening the conversation. One of them is you were at 5 million at that point in top line revenue, 30% EBITDA is a nice number, nice percentage. I missed this once with a company that cost me dearly, and I didn't take in some money at below 10 million. And I was right within striking, but I delayed. And what I missed was that there was a moment of a story and momentum and an opportunity to sell that actually, in this case, didn't have anything to do. So one, you could sell a company well below 10 million. And at one point in my life, I believe that 10 million was the magic first threshold and don't bother selling before 10 million top line. Bullshit. I helped a company that was doing only a little less than 4 million get a $21 million offer, right? So you don't even need to be close. It depends entirely. The other thing is, in your case, the EBITDA number was really important, and it can be really important and often is. But depending on what you're doing, you don't have to have a big profit number, right? You might want to have a great gross margin number, but I don't think you even need to worry about net profit in some cases. Depending on what we're selling and who we're selling to.
Yeah, I would say like tech, you know, SaaS products and stuff like that. It's not as much on the EBITDA number. In home service, this is just based on my experience. A lot of times they want to see the recurring revenue, which is what you had mentioned. Yes. And that's like, they want to see that number over, you know, a couple of years. That's the goal. Yeah. And then so like this company, he ended up going for 8X his EBITDA.
Yeah. So
it's still pretty good, right? It's not like a 3-ish something. Like it's pretty solid. The next company, it was like the third company that I consulted with. They were $3 million business, similar situation, came in, went to 8 million. Then they sold to a roll up. So that was a little bit of a different experience because they're like, you know, they want to keep him on with the earn out and roll in their systems. And they actually went out of business after 2 years. So it's like a whole different process. But EBITDA is definitely, I would say in home service, probably one of the bigger things in the recurring revenue for sure is really important.
So the focus in your case was like, where does this business come from? And is that a repeatable machine, right? Like getting one contract with one big company is can throw revenue, profit, even cash into your business. But that is not a recurring business machine. That is not like we know how to get business and customers. And that's what you had really done there. Before we unpack that, let's go back then a little more background. You know, where did you get your start? Where did you start to get bigger picture in this world? Like how did your career begin?
Yeah, I started at Enterprise Rent-A-Car in their management trainee program right out of college. So yeah, came out of college, management trainee. I ended up being one of the top branch managers at Enterprise, and we got paid off the bottom line. So a $3 million local service business. I got paid off the bottom line. I was 25. I had 20 team members. I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and he said, the number one skill you can learn is how to sell. So I went into their corporate office and I sold fleet management services to $10 million, $20 million, $100 million businesses that have fleets of vehicles. So they would have fleets. I would call on the CEOs, set up meetings with them and have them use Enterprise to manage their fleet. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I started a blog about personal finance. And I ended up getting 30, 40,000 people to my website reading every day. I was featured on Forbes, Yahoo Finance, CNBC, all this cool stuff. That was kind of like my foundation from a business perspective. I didn't like what I was doing at Enterprise. So I actually quit my job and bought a school bus and I made a little tiny home. And I traveled around the country making content. Then when I went to work at the home service business that was $3 million, he was one of my clients at Enterprise. All my worlds collided. I went to work there and I'm like, hey, where's the dashboard of how to look at leads year over year and jobs run year over year and average ticket? And he's like, what's that? Yeah. And I'm like, dude, we got to get the numbers in order so we can actually grow. And that's kind of how it all came to the point. And it was, I didn't know this whole like, you know, EBITDA PE side of things. It was just like, I just knew how to grow businesses because that's what I did at enterprise.
Mm. So let's actually peel that back. I don't know where this will go, but so I hear right off the bat, a guy with hustle who's willing to try different things. You're an enterprise. You're finding something. You're moving in on something else. You're building a tiny home. You're driving around. You're making content. You're not a shy guy.
No.
So what is it? What is this like character flaw, family problem that like led to this? Where did this start as with a young Phil? Like,
yeah. So it's kind of ironic. My dad, he still works at a pest control company. He's a service manager at a pest control company. So he was a technician my whole life. My first ever ride along was take your child to work day. I would ride around with him in his truck to run routes. Mm-hmm. Neither of my parents went to college. It was just like my mom is an immigrant, you know, family. So it's like there was never like just going to college and graduating was like you won the lottery, buddy. So like everything else is like gravy on top. So I kind of was just like, I'm going to just do as much as I can and just experience it. Like, what's the worst that's going to happen? So I would say that kind of like helped. The other big thing for me, I'm a Dave Ramsey guy. So, you know, he's in no debt, whatever, all this stuff. But like I paid off my student loans. I bought a condo with cash. I had no debt. So I really was like all defense. Like, let me go play some offense and get after it and just like try a bunch of stuff and figure it out. So I think both of those played a lot of it into it.
Now, do you still subscribe to that no debt world?
It's hard, man, because there's good debt, there's bad debt, you know, the whole thing. Yeah. And like you can make
money. Poor dad's all about debt. Like, take some debt. Like,
well, this is the thing. This is the thing that I kind of had this crossroads of like, you know, Robert Kiyosaki, Dave Ramsey, and how does that all correlate? I would say for me, from a personal perspective, I'm more conservative, but from a business perspective, I'm all for like getting after it and going for the gusto. So it's good.
And one of your parents is an immigrant?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mom, she's first generation Greek, and she went to kindergarten not knowing any Greek, not knowing any English, only spoke Greek. And it's pretty cool just to like hear her story. My parents were divorced, so she was going to college at night and I was going with her to classes and stuff. Just like, you know, the hustle and grind. Just
did you pick up Greek?
A little bit. Yeah, I took Greek classes growing up. I went to Greece a couple of times to visit family, so a little bit of stuff there.
I'm going to Greece this summer for 5 weeks.
Oh, where to?
I'll be on Rhodes.
That's where my family's from. Okay.
Is it?
Yes. So they're from a little town called Lindos, which is
Lindos. Yeah. I don't think I've ever been to Rhodes. I can't remember I've been to Greece a number of times, but I don't think I've ever been to Rhodes. But I picked the place because it has wind and I'm a wind sport guy.
Yeah.
And, so I'm going to go stay on the Ixia Beach side.
Yeah. Beautiful. Well, enjoy. Yeah. I went there a bunch when I was a kid, like probably from like 10 to around 15, because my grandparents had a house there. So it's nice.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Right. What are the chances of that? That's awesome. Right. So what do you think you learned from mom? Dad took you on the route.
Yeah. Mom was, don't be scared to fail. She used to share a lot of her failures with me. Mm-hmm. She also is my number one cheerleader out of everyone I've ever met is like, you know, just like, wow, I'm so proud of you getting after it. So it's like having someone in your corner. It was literally my mom and I, you know, until I was 18 and went off to college. So that also having structured finances, like I mentioned with the Dave Ramsey thing, was like, you know, talk about your budget. What does this look like? How are you going to plan for this? And one of the biggest things that she never said was like, I can't afford that. How are you going to afford that? One of the things that really stuck out to me about my mom, and I'll tell you this quick story. When I was about 8, our hot water heater went out and it flooded our whole basement. Like we only had 2 floors, but our main floor.
Yeah.
And we didn't have money to put a new hot water heater in or put floors down. And she was like, oh, no worries. Didn't you say you wanted to learn how to roller skate? I got you these roller skates. You can learn here in the cement for a couple months. And it's like making lemons out of lemonade, right? And it just like sticks with me. It's like, it can't get any worse than this. So like, let's just make it happen.
Yeah. Did you have any other businesses besides going around with your dad? Any other jobs or businesses before college?
Before college, yeah. I invested in this like VoIP thing. So I worked at Ruby Tuesdays when I was in high school as a waiter. And I did crypto type stuff, like penny stocks, you know. And then I did, I invested in this VoIP thing, spent like $1,000 to get like a website and some VoIP stuff. This was like in the early, late 2000s. So all those failed. I tried to start an app, you know, it's like random stuff.
You know, yeah, it's fascinating to me. My son did a couple different companies and like three in a row failed. And one was failing, but then he turned that work into a company that became known as Midjourney. Huge effing deal. So I think that we can have lots of failures in life and you can feel discouraged and you can feel down, and somehow like staying in action, staying focused, staying like I wouldn't be afraid to be upset. I was away this summer feeling down about a project I was working on and talking to a bunch of my entrepreneur friends at a retreat, and they were like, come on, man, you got to get up. And I'm like, no, I'm just going to be down for a minute. But then I came back and I like leaned into it. And then I turned, I'm like, okay, I'm going to be down, but I'm going to do some action anyway. And I use that to build some new business. So, and it gave me an insight to something that we'll keep playing with this year. So.
Yeah, very good. Even the blog that I mentioned I started, I did that for 4 years and I probably made $4,000 for 4 years because I'm like, oh, I could be this influencer, affiliate marketing, blah, blah, blah. And then now, like my business that we do, it generates like probably $100,000 in passive affiliate style income and I don't even really care that much. And it's like you learn all the skills and then it just, oh, now this opportunity came around the corner and everything comes together, which is basically how it happened for me. So you never know. Yeah.
So let's talk about some of the stories and the people that you've worked with. You worked with one company and they were focused on, they didn't have a lot of reviews and they were building their reviews. And I don't know, maybe talk about that one.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you like kind of the biggest things that we see when we work with home service businesses. So if someone's out there listening and they're like, hey, I want to buy a home service business or are these good deals? Yeah. These are kind of like
work recently with a collection of home service businesses.
Yeah. Okay. There's those three pillars that I mentioned. How do we get customers? How do we convert them? How do we retarget? I'll give you like specific ones for each that you probably never heard. So how do you get new customers? The number one thing that you could do is build B2B partnerships or referral partnerships. So like you mentioned, you had an HVAC guy and a plumbing guy. They could team up and pass referrals back and forth between their technicians. And instead of paying $100 or $200 for a lead on Google, they could pay $100 or $200 to a technician locally that's going to give them a warm lead. This game plan right here, I know that it will generate... Yeah, Calvo, there you go. I know that it will generate an additional $1.5 million in your business because at the duct cleaning company, this was their core offer when I came in to work there, was let's go find HVAC contractors and enroll them in our referral program and pay their technicians to be our sales force. So if you're listening to this, even if you're B2B or whatever... It's the number one way to get leads coming in and it's algorithm agnostic. You just set it up, you get leads coming in and they're warm leads at that. Mm-hmm. So that crushes in a lot of businesses. I'll give you another example. We have a wardrobe company that we work with. They do custom closets and wardrobes. They're about like $2 million. We set this up for them. We found a bunch of interior designers in and around them. We sent out a cold email that says partnership in the subject line. Came across your website looking for a good interior designer to partner with. Reach out to us if you want to, you know, talk about that. And they got one person right off the bat, $20,000 deal, partnership, good to go. It's going to keep paying. So that's a really big one for a lot of people. When we talk about the conversion funnel, and again, this is B2B, home service, whatever you are, the number one thing that we see is a lead nurture sequence is the biggest area of opportunity. You call an HVAC contractor or you fill out a form on their website, and then they call you and you don't answer. The lead's gone forever. This is why you need a text and an email and a conversation happening. So in this business, the duct cleaning company, they were converting their leads into jobs at 42%. We set up a text and an email to happen right away and they jumped up to 60%. With no more marketing spend, they got 18% more jobs.
That's a fundamental thing. So one, creating some automated immediate responses is really a great thing to do, but I feel like if you don't get a human being on really quickly with me, it's dead. I'm only willing to talk to a chat bot for a few minutes before I want to hear somebody who's, unless you've got the super AI forward chat bot that is really helpful. But if it's just friendly, but not actually helpful, yeah, like, boom, get me a person who's like, Bill, we're going to go out there tomorrow. I'll be there today. You know,
I agree. So one of the things that we recommend setting up, and I'll give you a little bit of a play on this coming into the future, is having online scheduling for your home service business or business in general. The reason is because, to your point, Bill, you just want to get your problem solved and you want to know when can you do it and maybe how much that it costs, but like, when can you do it? I already trust you guys. Yeah. There's this thing right now called agentic booking on Google.
Yeah.
Where are you familiar with it?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'll tell them. Basically, on Google in their AI platform, you can ask it for a restaurant and it's going to go to OpenTable and Resy and find an Italian restaurant and the time that it's available and then come back to you and say, do you want me to schedule this for you? For home service businesses, for B2B, whatever, that conversation from the AI side of things, it's going to correlate to all of our businesses because people are not going to go to your website and schedule and do all stuff. It's going to say, hey, how much does it cost to do this? And when's the next availability? What's the best company to work with? And then it's going to go and find the information and come back to them. Huge opportunity for a lot of businesses. And they're just like, oh, let me write this blog post and have someone go to my website and turn into a lead. It's changing in the next year or two.
So slow. Yeah. It's got to get faster.
Yeah, for sure. The third pillar from a retargeting perspective, I would say most businesses, and I mentioned this at the top, the PE guys, this is music to their ears. How do you retarget your past customers? We don't. Because they know that you paid for all these people that already know, like, and trust you, thousands of people, and you've never reached out to them once. And we have a saying, you can't get lifetime value without a lifetime relationship. So if you're never retargeting these people with an email or anything, how are you going to ever grow the business? You're just going to keep trying to get more leads coming in the top without getting the juice from the past customers. We had an HVAC contractor. They were 1.5 million. We sent out 12 emails, one every month, and they generated $263,000 in revenue just by sending out one email every single month. Imagine if they did two or three or called these people or whatever. So it crushes.
You know, it's interesting. So I have a pest control company. I'll spare them. I won't name them, right? But after every visit, they are incessant about sending me multiple reminders to review them, right?
Yeah.
Most of the time, I don't have anything to say. Was it good? Was it bad? I don't know. I don't have any thought about it. If I have heard or noticed pests around my house, then I have a thought that the service was good or bad. But the quality of his service, I don't know. I wasn't home. He came by when I wasn't here. He did his thing. He went off. It's like a regular visit. You know, they spray, they set traps, they do whatever they do. I don't even know actually what they do right now. And until then, like, so I don't have an opinion. But if they sent me a thing saying, hey, you know, Tony was just by your place today and here's what happened and here's how it went and everything looks good, and let us know if we can be of any other help or if you have any other thing. And by the way, is there anyone else in your neighborhood that you think we should talk to? Oh, that'd be useful. But asking me for endless reviews after another, like, you get a review from me every now and then, or get a review after you do something where there's some interaction. So I sent him a message recently over the weekend and said, we have a problem. Like, there is a significant infestation under the house. It's some pests. I don't all know what's down there, but there's movement, nesting, and we got to do something.
Yeah.
Now, the speed that they answer and get me scheduled is the first data point. The technician showing up and diagnosing the problem and giving me a solution that I feel like is right-sized is the second thing. Then actually fixing it. Those are all actually good provable data points where I might have a positive experience, but I've got an issue now. Solve it. Now check my satisfaction. And then ask me if anyone, but I'm going to start telling people, like, I'll tell my neighbor, oh yeah, we had a thing. And so we had to do this and we did these things, and I'm like, okay, good. That sounds good. Hey, I have that problem, or I've been noticing something, you know? So I think that, like, leaning into, like, over-indexing on reviews, right? A little bit of review. Great. But then actually serve people and ask for a lead, ask for a referral. I asked one of my clients recently, I asked a couple of them, hey, we're going to have an opening for one of this, like, tier of client. We have a couple different tiers. And I don't have a lot of opening. Only a few of those can I do a year. And do you know anybody I should talk to? And almost immediately he referred me to someone, and it was great because I, like, trust who he talks to and who he think, like, he's a valued client. I want more people like him, you know?
Yeah. I will say this. the customer experience is going to be a huge differentiator come AI. Once AI is fully ingrained, and you have been mentioned it with your experience of I want a human, the more that you can build real stuff into your customer experience. So I'll give you an example with the pest control guy. Imagine if he, after he got into his truck, took out his phone and recorded a quick video. Hey, Mr. Gallagher, just finished up at your home. I noticed this, this, and this. Here's what I did. By the way, like that experience that takes 30 seconds, if they put that on his technician checklist that he has to do that, and if he got performance pay off of getting more referrals from you, he can make more money. You can have a much better customer experience and everyone can win.
Right.
People are not thinking that. They're just thinking, I need more reviews so that I can rank higher on Google. And it's just very transactional in nature.
Right.
Customer experience, the more that we can focus on that, the biggest differentiator every single business is going to have.
So in the case of my pest control guys, we'll see what how they handle this flare up. But setting that aside for a minute, thinking just generically about the long-term thing, if after he left each time, he sent me a message saying, I just checked your traps. I just serviced the house. Here's all the things I noticed. I had a little bit of an issue there. If he gave me a report, I'd have some positive review, right?
Of course.
And I think a lot of times I had my car serviced recently, and the car dealership sent me video. And so they had the car all day. It was just a regular periodic maintenance. And they sent me video and like, okay, here's all the things they inspected. And they're like, these look good. This looks good. This looks good. This, hey, these two things need replacement. And then they gave me a box like I could just click off. I didn't have to talk to anyone, but I had the equivalent of like a human interaction because he's talking me through on the video. And then he just like uploads it to whatever their app is. Their app sends it to me and their app includes the estimate. And I could just click okay. And they added two, you know, additional cost service items on it that I was cool with, right?
Exactly.
Brilliant. And I was like, wow, they're like, they use technology in a way that didn't feel cold or disconnected. And I loved them. And it's the first time I had that, right? So.
Yes. Yeah. I think the more, and this is the hard part with AI and automation, is that it blurs the line between building trust and just checking a box in your customer experience. And I think the more that you can layer in video or just real organic stuff, like one of the things that we coach our clients on is having videos in your actual sales process. So for example, you send someone an estimate, you could record a one video that says, hey, Bill, just sent you this estimate. I put this in there and then this in there. It's because you told me about this and this and this. Here's a common objection that we get, you know, that and put that, it takes 5 minutes. You just put together an estimate, just lump that in there. Your close rate will go up because no one else is doing this and it builds trust.
I think if your AI assistant is useful, if it could actually do something, schedule something, resolve something, estimate something, great. If it's just answering when your hours are, or like if it's just being polite, like I don't need that. Like that's yesterday's AI, right? That's not today's kind of AI that's going to help me actually solve something. So,
yeah, I agree.
All right, let's talk about cookie cutter marketing playbooks. Tell me the worst story, the worst example of what you've seen and how you fix something, right? There's a lot of people. I get multiple times a day, and I know our clients do, pitches from people with their cookie cutter marketing BS that I'm sure those companies hope will work, but I have zero confidence in and never am willing to try.
Yeah. Well, good news. Me too, because I was at this home service business. I came in as director of business development, right? My job is to help the company grow. So we have these cookie cutter agencies that I'm working with that I'm trying to get them to grow their business and I can't get them to cross the finish line. So I felt this exact same point, which is why I made this. I'm actually writing a book on this and the title I think is going to be called Second Engine, which is what got you to $1 million or $10 million is not going to get you over the hump. And there's a second engine of growth that you need from a marketing perspective. And it has three core parts. It's like a triangle. So you need good digital marketing, but more importantly, you need good data. Because the reason that most owners don't trust these marketing companies when they say, oh, we're going to rank you number one on Google is because they don't have the data to prove it. Every time you talk to them, they say, spend more on ads. Or yeah, our SEO is working, this black magic of voodoo. But you don't know if this is actually working in your business or not. So like what I uncovered was I had to start pulling return on ad spend on every single channel. So that way I can make the decision if it's working or not. And my agency was like fractionalized cookie cutter out here. And then the other pillar is automation. So you need your marketing to pull into your CRM to communicate back and forth to make sure that it's all working. And these cookie cutter agencies, they just do SEO and run some ads and pray to the Google gods that they send you leads and bless you. But there's no data or anything, right? It's just like they're out here. Then you have data in your CRM. Hopefully it all makes sense. And then you have some automation tech stack over here. And there's nothing working together to actually grow in an engine format.
Yeah.
Sound familiar?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is exactly what I face. And this is why I literally built my company, because business owners need that.
Yeah. Well, tell us a good story then of somebody and something you built. Add some color to that.
Yeah. So I was at my home service business. We're spending $5,000 a month on ads. And I went to my agency because it was shoulder season. Shoulder season is January to February. And that time, there's usually not much demand. So I say, hey, I need jobs on the books. They said, well, your cost per lead and conversions is this amount of money. So you could just spend more money and get more leads coming in. And I'm like, okay, well, how do I know it's that is profitable? How do I know it's actually turning into revenue? Well, you need to go in your CRM and figure this out. This is the plague that most people face. So I'll give you another example. We just started working with this $7 million home service business. He was spending $22,000 a month on Google Ads, $22,000 a month. We asked him in the sales process, how do you track your return on ad spend? I don't. So you're spending $22,000 a month and you don't know if it's making you $0 or $100,000. Like what?
Right.
So we plug in return on ad spend reporting in the first month. He spent $22,000. He made $22,000.
Yes.
And usually this will say that there's two problems in your business. One, your lead quality is bad. Or two, your lead intake process is bad. You don't have a good process for turning leads into appointments. So we need to figure out what it is. So we need to go to listen to the calls, or we need to audit your intake process. That's another example. Another one, this is a perfect example for they don't know the data, so they're actually holding back their growth. We started working with this $10 million plumbing company. They were spending $2,500 a month on Google, like not even that much. But they didn't know that it was producing a 10x return, $2,500, $25K. So the first month, we're like, we're like 10x, double that thing. So they went from 2,500 to 5,000, 10x return.
Yeah.
So the good data makes good decisions both ways. Should we do more of this or less of this? And we see this. This is the reason that cookie cutter is cookie cutter, is because it's just, hey, Bill, let me fit you into this cookie cutter system and just let it run. And like, you just tell me if it's working.
We did this for another home service business. We did this for another consulting company. So let's run that with you. Like, who knows if that's going to work or not. Yeah. I think thoughtfully looking at each point in your process, right? What problem are we solving? Who are we talking to? What do we say to them? What do they call looking for? What do they like? That whole flow, I think, is what I hear you. And then bringing actual data. What are the numbers here? Like, feeling good about a conversation is not the same as we had X conversations that produced Y results. We went through that kind of that flow.
Yeah. With the private equity guy, we go to lunch and he says, how do you get new customers? And I say, well, we're spending $10,000 on Google Ads and it's performing at a 10X return. Mm-hmm. And right, like, imagine how much more confidence he's going to have that we have the data and I can show him the information.
What else is important in getting ready to sell? What have you noticed? What stories have you seen with people who were or weren't ready to sell?
Yeah. So specifically, we work with companies that are like $1 to $10 million in revenue. And the biggest thing that I would say is this key man risk piece. Usually, you can't be the number one salesperson or closer on your company in your company. So you have to build a professional sales system. So we had a company, they were $2 million and went to $4 million in 1 year. They went on Inc. 5000 fastest growing companies, and then private equity went crazy. Mm-hmm. So, and they ended up selling. But what the business owner had to do was build a professional sales system in his company, aside from him just coming on and sounding smart or going to the meeting and sounding smart. So,
yeah, hang on, pause. So, key man risk, that is both sales and operations. If you're central to the whole business, you can't sell. So, you got to take what you do and turn that into a playbook and build some team around it.
That's right. And the more that you can just own the business instead of actually running the business, that is the beauty of it. And even if you don't sell, it's just like building to sell, right? So, so that is a big thing that we see a lot of. And it was, to be honest, at the duck cleaning company, it was one of the hiccups that they kind of ran into because the owner was going out on doing the commercial sales, but they ended up overcoming that. That one. And then I would say in home service, like profitability is so crucial because a lot of these guys, a lot of the homeowners, the home service business owners are technicians that turned into business owners. So like they know how to, do the stuff like through and through. But the problem is that these guys from private equity come in and they don't necessarily have the chops to like do the blue collar stuff, right? Like they don't have the trades experience. So they need to know that when I pull this guy out, that it's not going to fall apart. Like he's not the number one firefighter over here. And that they, in spite of him not knowing how to run a business, they're still profitable.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a big, big part of it.
You know, it's an interesting thing. I think about like, so there are companies that aren't really home services. So you think about like roofing and you think about paving. And well, let's just stick to those as examples. So roofing, right? How often do you put a roof on your house? Well, I've lived in my house for 30 years this year, and I put on one roof and I hope never to do it again, yes. Right? So do I need a service? Is that a home service? Yeah, well, it could be. So if I put gutters on and then I need gutters periodically, then I've upgraded that. Now maybe I put gutter covers, so I need it a lot less often. Same thing with paving. So I redid my driveway, right? And I changed out some of the pavements and stuff in the backyard and side yard. So you know, that's not a maintenance thing, but every year I need power washing. Because we get significant algae growth, particularly on our bricks, all of the brick walkways. That's an annual kind of a thing. And then that goes with like, okay, well, maybe I need to also do my windows and maybe I need to do the roofs and gutters. And so there's a world of that needs to go on the regular. And if you could figure out something, and we talked to the paving company that was filling in their off season with doing like snow removal and other kinds of maintenance. And so if you could figure out how to turn your crews into regular, like ongoing kinds of things, now we've added some upgrade, right?
Yeah, for sure. And what I would say is the duct cleaning business that I was at, duct cleaning is something that you might get done every 5 years. It's not like every single year you have to get your ducts cleaned, but, and he still sold for 8X, right? The biggest selling point for him was that he had recurring business coming from his partners that I mentioned. So yes. Like the roofing contractor, for example. Yeah. It was a big engine that was a reselling opportunity that was like, this has recurring revenue because of all these partnerships. So like the roofing contractor, that person could partner with gutter cleaning companies, pressure washing companies, siding companies. And basically like they're already doing this stuff, you know, all the time, like what you're saying, but then they have this engine and they could use them in their email newsletter and retargeting, not just like residential customer. You don't need to email every single month about getting a new roof. But if you had partnerships with people, then you could stay top of mind and be developing that network. This was a huge part of the resale of the company that I was at with the duct cleaning, was that they had these partnerships built out and they had a whole relationship and it was really recurring because they were sending them. You could look at the whole lifespan of the last 5 years and see all the deals they were sending them.
I think so that we're touching on the services and the recurring revenue side of things. My HVAC company, right? My old one, you know, I found through a referral, they came in and they gave me a new furnace, and then they came in, they added an AC unit on. So two big projects, and then they added a splitter system and so on. Terrible company, like dishonest, like terrible quality work, that kind of thing. I went shopping around. I found somebody else to replace and service the thing ongoingly. What do they do now? The new company does twice a year. So they come twice a year and they like beginning of the summer, the beginning of the fall, and they like give it a safety inspection, tune up, things like that. And in fact, the thing that I had just right now, they probably would have found, but because of my travel, I avoided scheduling them in the fall.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh yeah. And I got busy and I forgot about it. And so we didn't do the periodic maintenance that found the problem. We might've found it a little bit earlier. And it might've actually saved me significant in my heating, in my power bill.
That's right.
Because of the electric and gas, we were throwing all kinds of heating and cooling into the basement, which I mean, into the subfloor, the crawl space. Why I didn't need to do that, right? That probably was adding to the pest problem, creating a very cozy environment for the pests, right?
Yeah.
So that thing that they do, they show up and they're like, they check the heating cooling levels, they check the airflow, that kind of thing from time to time. They're like, oh, we see a problem here. But that also led them to saying, hey, we see a leak in a pipe under there. We've got a plumbing division. So it could have been a referral, but in this case, it was their own company. Exactly. Our plumbing division can come out and fix that for you. I'm like, great, have them come estimate it. Exactly. And then while you're at it, hey, oh, we have this thing, this valve and faucet up here needs some attention. So we're going to end up doing a whole bunch of extra little work, right? That we might have lived with for a while.
Yeah. So memberships in home service is like hand in hand with private equity money. They just basically want to see memberships. So what we found is that for every $1 million of revenue, you should have 500 memberships. So $2 million in revenue, 1,000 memberships. And the reason that memberships are so good to what your point is like, one, it's good for the consumer because you have someone who's on top of you to be like, hey, you need to get these tune-ups. But two, it's a cross-sell opportunity for you to get your eyes on stuff, sell other things in the home. Hopefully they have a checklist, which you probably had a checklist and said, hey, you need this and this and this. And it's basically diagnosing. The customer's paying to be diagnosed and cross-sold. Yeah. But it's also good for you because you don't have to try to remember to schedule things.
So let's recap before we run out of time here. If you want to create a great saleable business, right, you could sell it at any size. It doesn't have to be $10, $20, $100 million. It could be at a smaller number, and maybe that's enough for you. But don't get your thoughts set on it. We're looking for recurring revenue, a business growth model. Do we have a source of leads? Are you actually doing anything converting leads? Do you know which ones are worth more? And are you central to either sales and marketing or the execution process? If you're critical to either of those, you're going to have some real trouble. So
that's exactly right.
Big call outs on it. Let's build a custom playbook that makes your business a repeatable business engine, and that's worth more. If you want to find out more from Phil, check out Flash Consulting. Flash Consulting, music came in hot there. Flash Consulting is Phil's website. He does work if you're in the home service business. Our lessons, our comments here apply to every kind of business, but in particular, his work is with the home services business. So you need marketing for your home service business. I know a couple that we'll share this with in our world that maybe could use some help with this kind of thing. But it's been a pleasure talking to you today, Phil.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. I appreciate you having me on. And for those business owners out there, please try to remove yourself from the operation and build a business that can be sellable, whether you sell or not. It's going to save you a lot of headache and anxiety and give you a lot of fulfillment.
Go find more of our shows. Where are we getting this right now? 650 plus episodes there on everything to do with growing your business. Hope it's been helpful. You'll also find our website, scalingcoach.com, with information about our programs, our different coaching levels, all the kinds of companies that Phil's talking about here. We've got a growth cohort program for them, that 1 to 20 million kind of range that's much far more affordable than our private coaching. You'll find all that at scalingcoach.com. Thanks again, everyone, for watching, for listening. Thanks to my friend and mentor, Vern Harnish, who created the whole scaling up framework that's the core of our business, to our producers, Anna and Wanda, for getting our show at the door. Until next time, keep scaling. Thanks again for listening. I'm writing a book now called Busy is Broken. If this episode resonated with you, you'll probably enjoy the book too. It's coming September of 2026. To follow along, go to busyisbroken.com. That's busyisbroken.com.